Thank you everyone for coming to listen to my story, the story of every Gazan. I think 2 years ago I was here for a reading from my first poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. And by the way, it is the same copy that I had when I read here. This is the only book that survived with me. You saw the books in the picture. This is maybe just 10% of my book collection. And when I left my house on October 12th, just a week after Israel started its genocide, I mean, I looked at the books. What should I take with me? I thought, I've never imagined, to be honest, I've never imagined that this house would be bombed. I mean, it is filled with books. Books from everywhere in the world. And it's filled with love, family love, my parents, the garden that I showed you, the trees, everything. I mean, I could never imagine that this house would turn into a pile of rubble. But this book was the only book that survived with me. And I remember that when I was abducted, I had this book in my small bag that I was carrying with me. And when I was released, the Israeli soldiers dropped me at the same checkpoint from where they took me. And I found the bag, and the book was inside the bag still. So this book had a journey. So I'm going to just start by reading. I'm not going to read some poems that I read in the past, because the walls would recognize the poems. I'll just only read the title poem, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. It's by coincidence, it's on page 92, the year of my birth. Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. For Alicia M. Quesnel, MD. 1. When you open my ear, touch it gently. My mother's voice lingers somewhere inside. Her voice is the echo that helps me recover equilibrium when I feel dizzy during my attentiveness. You may encounter songs in Arabic, poems in English I recite to myself, or a song I chant to the chirping birds in our backyard. When you stitch the cut, don't forget to put all these back in my ear. Put them back in order as you would do with the books on your shelf. 2. The drone's buzzing sound, the roar of an F-16, the screams of bombs falling on houses, on fields, and on bodies, of rockets flying away. Rid my tiny ear canal of them all. Spray the perfume of your smiles on the incision. Inject the song of life into my veins to wake me up. Gently beat the drum so my mind may dance with yours, my doctor, day and night. So my second book is called Forest of Noise, and half of the poems in the book were written before October 7th, some of which were written while I was doing my MFA here. And I'm sure that when you read the book, you will be unable to distinguish the poems that were written before or after. Obed. To the shadow I had left behind, to the shadow that I had left alone before I crossed the border, my shadow that stayed lonely and hid in the dark of the night, freezing where it was, never needing a visa. To my shadow, that's been waiting for my return, homeless except when I was walking by its side in the summer light. To my shadow that wishes to go to school with the children of morning, but couldn't fit through the classroom doors. To my shadow that has caught cold now, that's been sneezing and coughing, no one there saying to it, God bless. To my shadow that's been crushed by cars and vans, it's a chest pierced by shrapnel and bullets, flying with no wings. My shadow that no one's attending to, bleeding black blood through its memory, now and forever. Thank you. Thank you. So that was one of the poems that I wrote for a class at Syracuse. I will not tell you about every poem. So this is a poem that consists of small poems. I will just read some excerpts. Gaza Notebooks, 2021-2023. At fifth grade, I visit the school library. On a wall by the door, a poster claims, "If you read books, you live more than one life." Now I'm 30, I'm 32 now. Now I'm 30, and whenever I look at faces around me, old or young, on each forehead I read, "If you live in Gaza, you die several times." She asked her teacher, "If there are four directions, then why do we have only 2 feet?" No one at home. I mean, I wrote this about the Nakba, 1948, but now it applies to what's happening in Gaza. No one at home, the doorknob, only dust touches it now. Pots grow parched. Frying pans miss the smell of olive oil. Clothes lines everywhere pine for soap scent. The flower pot, the window, the key, the language. Stones of house after the explosion get amnesia. Some forget they were in a wall in a bedroom or a kitchen or a bathroom. Some in a ceiling. Some forget they sat behind photo frames for years. A few stones forget they were stones, those hit by the bomb. In the camp, the house, small, power off, humid, drone sounds buzz in through bullet holes. To have walls is a blessing. Outside, young and old spend most of the night in the street. In the camp, a street can become a living room. Talking, watching cats and mice scavenging through trash for cheese or meat. Rooms inside, drawers for tired souls temporarily stored. My dreams as a child. I still have dreams about a room filled with toys my mother always promised we could have if we were rich. I still have dreams about seeing the refugee camp from a window on a plane. I still have dreams about seeing the animals I learned about in third grade: elephant, giraffe, kangaroo, and wolf. I still have dreams about running for miles and miles with no border blocking my feet, with no unexploded bombs scaring me off. I still have dreams about my favorite team playing soccer in the beach, me waiting for the ball to come my way and run away with it. I dream still about my grandfather. His name is Hassan. How much I want to pick oranges with him in Yafa. But my grandfather died. Yafa is occupied, and oranges no longer grow in his weeping groves. My son throws a blanket over my daughter. This is a poem that I wrote about a video that I took of my daughter Yafa. The video dates back to May 2021. It's when Israel attacked Gaza for 11 days. And that was the first time we were watching and hearing new bombs that Israel started to use. Of course, now, every day, you will hear these bombs, and I may play some sound recording of some of the bombings that I took. So in the video, I was filming Yafa. We were sitting in our hallway of our house, and she wanted to hide. She heard the bomb, and then she said, "Oh, there's a bomb." And then her son, her brother Yazan, 2 years older than her, threw a blanket over her and said, "You can hide now." And so this poem is called "My Son Throws a Blanket Over My Daughter." Gaza, May 2021. At night, at home, we sit on the floor, close to each other, far from the windows and the red lights of bombs. Our backs bang on the walls whenever the house shakes. We stare at each other's faces, scared yet happy that so far our lives have been spared. The walls wake up from their fitful sleep. No arms to wipe at their blurry eyes. Flies gather around the only lit ceiling lamp for warmth in the bitter night. Cold except when missiles hit and burn up houses and roads and the trees. The neighborhood next to us, where Yazan learned to ride his bike, is scorched. Every time we hear a bomb falling from an F-16 or an F-35, our lives panic. Our lives freeze somewhere in between, confused where to head next. A graveyard, a hospital, a nightmare. I keep my shivering hand over my wristwatch, ready to remove the battery if needed. My four-year-old daughter, Yaffa, wearing a pink dress given to her by a friend, hears a bomb explode. She gasps, covers her mouth with her dress's ruffles. Yazan, her 5.5-year-old brother, grabs a blanket warmed by his sleepy buddy. He lays the blanket on his sister. "You can hide now," he assures her. Thank you. No art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Elizabeth Bishop. You know everything will come to an end. The sugar, the tea, the dried sage, the water. Just go to the market and restock. Even your shadow will abandon you when there is no light. So just keep things that require only you. The book of poems that only you can decipher. The blank map of a country whose cities and villages only you can recognize. I've personally lost 3 friends to war, a city to darkness, and a language to fear. This was not easy to survive, but survival proved necessary to master. But of all things, losing the only photo of my grandfather under the rubble of our house was a real disaster. I mean, I wrote this before October 7th. Because I say here, I lost 3 friends to war. And that was in 2014. I lost 3 close friends. And I mentioned their names in my first poetry book, Izzat, Ammar, and Ismail. And here in the book, in this poem, I said, the book of poems that only you can decipher, the blank map of a country whose cities and villages only you can recognize. And now I'm thinking about the whole cities and villages and neighborhoods in Gaza that were destroyed. Now, I look at the photos, and I don't know what street this is, even in my city. So now I'm struggling to know which street in the city this is, whether this was a mosque, this was a pharmacy, whether this was a kindergarten. So now it's not only about the blank map of a country that only you can recognize, whose cities and villages only you can recognize. But now we have to struggle from now on to recognize from the photos and videos. And even when unless you are on the ground, you can make it through the houses and see, oh, this is Ahmed's house, this is my friend's house, this is the school, and this is the market, etc. So now it's more than struggling to locate the cities and villages on a map. It's even locating the places in pictures, places that you used to visit every day, your neighbor's house, your grandparents' house. So this next one is, we are looking for Palestine. The sun rises and moves around. It sets to visit other places, and we are looking for Palestine. The birds wake up and look for food. They chirp on the blossoming trees laden with fruit, with peaches, apples, apricots, and oranges. And we are looking for Palestine. The sea waves lap against the shore. They glitter and dance with the fishers' boats. And we are looking for Palestine. People travel to relatives and friends. They book round-trip tickets, stuff their suitcases with gifts and books and clothes. And we are still looking for Palestine. Sir, we have no airports and seaports, no trains, no highways. We have no passable roads, sir. We do have crutches and wheelchairs. Young men with one or no legs, no longer able to work as if there was work. We travel to the West Bank or Egypt for surgery, even to set a broken leg, but we need a permit to enter. We stuff our suitcases with pictures and memories. They feel very heavy on the road, on the ground. We can't carry them, neither can the roads. They scar the surface of the earth. We get lost in the past, the present, and the future. When a child is born, we feel sad for him or her. A child is born to suffer here, sir. A mother feels the great pain in labor. A child cries after leaving her dark place. In Palestine, our dark is not safe. In Palestine, children always cry. If we want to travel, we leave many times. And Syracuse is familiar with my attempts at traveling and coming back for the program. If we want to travel, we leave many times. In Gaza, you leave via Erez, either Erez or Rafah, a hard escape to make. So we search for the visa interview. Cairo, Istanbul, Amman, but not in Palestine. We don't have embassies there. The one in Jerusalem is farther than the Andromeda galaxy. Andromeda is 2.5 million light years away. But our years stay heavy and dark. It would take trillions of years. Sir, we are not welcome anywhere. Only cemeteries don't mind our bodies. We no longer look for Palestine. Our time is spent dying. Soon, Palestine will search for us, for our whispers, for our footsteps, our fading pictures fallen off blown up walls. So every time I read a poem, I need to comment. So here, so because this was written before October 7th. So here in the poem, I said, only cemeteries don't mind our bodies. And now this is not true because Israel has destroyed cemeteries and our bodies are not welcome because of the danger. So Israel destroyed cemeteries, and people, because of the Israeli siege, even during their attacks, people had to bury people in the street, even in schoolyards, even in hospital yards, even in their house yards. There is one picture that I recognize the area. There is a picture of something like a grave in the middle of the street. And there was something like a gravestone, but it was on a cardboard box. And it didn't even mention the name of this guy who was buried. It said he was wearing a blue shirt and black jeans. This is what they said. And he was fat. That's what. So this is what the name of this guy was. And he was buried in the middle of a street that leads to the sea. It's close to the Mina, the Gaza seaport. I recognize the street. So only cemeteries don't mind our bodies. I'm so sorry, my poem, but it's not the case right now. My library. So I wrote this poem after I went back to Gaza in first time. I was in Syracuse. I went back to Gaza in February 2021, 3 months before Israel attacked Gaza in May. So there was one airstrike, and this is the poem is about this. My library. My books remain on the shelves as I left them last year, but all the words have died. I search for my favorite book out of a place. I find it lying in a drawer next to the photo album and my old Nokia phone. The pen inside the book is still intact, but some ink drops have leaked. Some words breathe its ink, the pen like a ventilator for a dozen words. Home, Jerusalem, the sea, Haifa, the rock, the oranges, the sand, the pigeon, Cairo, my mother, Beirut, books, the rock, the sea, the sea. I'm not sure how many of you watched me read before. I'm repeating the same stories for everyone. I'm not sure. But I'm going to read three poems, and these poems are some kind of special for me. because they hold the memories of some people, or they are about something that never ceased to happen. This poem is called Right or Left. So I'm going to read the poem and tell the story. So the story behind this poem is that many people, including some relatives of mine, were killed in their houses, and their bodies remain under the rubble until now. I mean, at least there are three people that Maram and I know. We don't know them, but we know their siblings. We met two siblings in Egypt while we were in exile, before we came to Syracuse. And the two sisters were the only survivor of the airstrike. That airstrike took place in November 2023, just a week after I was released. I met the two sisters in Deir al-Balah Hospital, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. And I know their brother, Ismail Abu Ghabin, because he taught Arabic in a school close to us. So Ismail was killed in that airstrike. His two children were killed. His parents were killed. And three other sisters were killed. So only two sisters survived. So I met them in the hospital. One of them was unconscious. The other was conscious. She knew what happened, but the other sister, who was unconscious, didn't know anything. So it's a miracle that when we went to Egypt in December 2023, we lived on Street 15, and the two girls were referred to a hospital in Egypt that was on Street 9. So we were just six streets away from each other. So I used to visit them with Maram and the kids. I mean, nearly every day we used to go to the hospital to just say hi, sit with them, talk to them. So one thing why I mentioned this story, because the sisters were asking me whether it was possible for them to return to Gaza. So that was probably January or February 2024, just 2 months after they left Gaza. I told them, why? I mean, people are paying a lot of money to leave Gaza. I told them, why do you want to go back to Gaza? They said, the bodies of my father, Ismail, and another sister are still under the rubble, and we want to go back and dig through the rubble and bury them. So this poem, and I have relatives also who were killed a few months ago, and their bodies are still under the rubble until now. So this poem is about a sister of these two sisters whose body is still under the rubble. Her name is Ikram. She is 15 years old. Right or left? Under the rubble, her body has remained for days and days. When the war ends, we try to remove the rubble, stone after stone. We only find one small bone from her body. It is a bone from her arm. Right or left, it does not matter as long as we cannot find the henna from her neighbor's wedding on her skin, or the ink from a school pen on a little index finger. The other poem is called The Moon. So this poem, The Moon, I wrote it while I was in Egypt watching my people, my friend, my family killed on a daily basis, and they were starved by the Israeli forces and by this administration also. And I not only watched people struggling to find food, but also cats and dogs. To the extent that some cats and dogs were feeding on the bodies of people who were killed and whose bodies were left in the street for days and weeks. So I watched this video of a few cats, and I still have it on my phone, of a few cats feeding on the body of a young man who was killed while he was riding his bike. His bike was next to him. The other thing about which I wrote this poem was a photo of a father and his daughter who were killed in the street, and they were carrying still while they were killed. They were wearing their backpacks. And if you wonder why you see people in Gaza carrying their backpacks, it's because it is their suitcases. I mean, I said that we don't have an airport in Gaza, right? So it means that people do not travel. So they don't have suitcases. So when they move from one shelter to another, from one house to another, from one school to another, they would put their clothes, their food, whatever they have, anything, in their children's school bags, or in plastic bags, or in small carts. So I wrote this poem after I watched this video of that young man whose body was eaten by cats. And also after I saw the picture of this girl who was killed next to her father. I mean, they were just very close to each other and they were lying on their bellies in the street. The moon. She's lying on the asphalt, her small belly, her chest, her forehead, her hands, her cold feet bare in the night. A hungry cat paces, shrapnel rings as it hits neighboring houses already bombed. The hungry cat sees the girl, her wounds still warm, hungrier. The girl's father lies next to her on his back. The backpack he wears still has the girl's favorite candy and a small toy. The girl was waiting till they arrived to eat her lollipop. The cat gets close to try the flesh. A bomb pounds the street. No flesh, no girl, no father, no cat. Nobody is hungry. The moon overhead is not the moon. Okay, so I will read one small poem and then one long poem. So this small poem, it's not small really, because it is big for me. So this one is called What a Gazan Should Do During an Israeli Airstrike. So now I decided to play some sound recordings. So in Gaza, you could hear so many different sounds of Israeli military airstrikes or artillery shelling or gunshots or the drones buzzing sound. So this one recording, I have recording that lasts for about 2 hours, 3 hours. Sometimes I would sleep and keep the recorder on. So this one was taken on my birthday, November 17th, 2 days before I was abducted. And that night, November 17th, was one reason why I decided to leave North Gaza and go south in the hope of leaving Gaza with my wife and kids. So this one is a recording of artillery shelling, and you will hear three different sounds. The one is when the shell was fired. The second is the whirring sound of the bomb in the air. And the third one is the explosion of the bomb. I mean, I don't have to explain. You will. I don't know why I explain everything. So we were in a school shelter. You hear people, you know, chatting together. It was 11 p.m. This is a baby. So this is artillery. Now this one has, this is a video. I'm not going to play it. This one video was also taken on November 17th at 11 p.m. This time you will hear both artillery shelling and airstrikes, because sometimes people will think this is maybe fire, gunfire. But no, these are bombs that wipe out complete neighborhoods. This is my voice in Arabic. This is me.
لا تقلقوا 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 لا
I'm explaining what's happening. So, this is a 5-minute long video. So, what a Gazan should do during an Israeli airstrike. And this poem was written in May 2021. Because I say this because this poem should not be followed by any Gazan right now in Gaza, because it does not work. It used to work in the past, but now, with Israel's obliteration of neighborhoods, it does not work. What a Gazan should do during an Israeli airstrike. Turn off the lights in every room. Sit in the inner hallway of the house, away from the windows. Stay away from the stove. Stop thinking about making black tea. Have a bottle of water nearby, big enough to cool down children's fear. Get a child's kindergarten backpack and stuff tiny toys and whatever amount of money there is, and the ID cards and photos of late grandparents, aunts or uncles, and the grandparents' wedding invitation that's been kept for a long time. And if you are a farmer, you should put some strawberry seeds in one pocket and some soil from the balcony flower put in the other, and hold on tight to whatever number there was on the cake from the last birthday. And if you wonder, where did this image of, you know, keeping the last number that was on the cake from the last birthday? Because Israel attacked Gaza on May 11th, and my Mustafa, you know, the red-haired boy, so May 2nd was his first birthday. So that's where I got that image. It's from Mr. Mustafa's birthday. So very thankful to him again. This last poem was written after October 7th, and it's made up of smaller poems. It's one of the most important things that I wrote, because every poem is a representative of the genocide in Gaza. Under the rubble. She slept on her bed, never woke up again. Her body has become her grave, a tomb beneath the ceiling of her room, the ceiling a cenotaph. No name, no year of birth, no year of death, no epitaph. Only blood and a smashed picture frame in ruin next to her. In Jabalia camp, a mother collects her daughter's flesh in a piggy bank, hoping to buy her a plot on a river in a faraway land. Maram's uncle was killed in December 2023, just a few days. وقتش استشهد خالي؟ عشرة عشرة 12 So on December 10th, just 4 days after Rifat, my friend was killed. So her uncle, her maternal uncle, was born deaf and mute, and he was a father of two children. The youngest, قديش عمر أصغر واحد؟
1 year.
1 year. The smallest was 1 year old. Sorry. And he was abducted from inside a school shelter in Beit Lahia. He was taken to Kamal Adwan Hospital when Israel at the time turned it into an interrogation center. And then a few hours after that, sorry, you can talk. So a few hours later, he was released. And he went, by the way, they took off all his clothes. So when he was released, he didn't find his clothes. So some of the doctors and nurses in the hospital gave him their gowns, white gowns. So Nassim walked back to the school shelter. And by the time he arrived, it was burned because everyone was expelled and it was burned. It is the same school where my son Yazan went for his first and second grade, and where Yafa started just her first grade. So by the time he arrived at the gate to the school, he was shot by a sniper. And there was a picture of him at the gate of the school wearing white gown. And people were saying, who is that doctor there? So he was born deaf and mute. I mean, this in itself is a tragedy. So this part is for him. A group of mute people were talking sign. When a bomb fell, they fell silent. It rained again last night. The new plant looked for an umbrella in the garage. The bombing got intense, and our house looked for a shelter in the neighborhood. I leave the door to my room open so the words in my books, the titles and names of authors and publishers, could flee when they hear the bombs. I became homeless once, but the rubble of my city covered the streets. They could not find a stretcher to carry your body. They put you on a wooden door they found under the rubble. Your neighbors, a moving wall. The scars on our children's faces will look for you. Our children's amputated legs will run after you. He left. This is a true poem, and it happened again and again to so many other fathers who went to get some bread for their kids. He left the house to buy some bread for his kids. News of his death made it home, but not the bread. No bread. Death sits to eat whoever remains of the kids. No need for a table. No need for bread. A father wakes up at night, sees the random colors on the walls drawn by his four-year-old daughter. The colors are about 4 feet high. Next year, they would be five. But the painter had died in an airstrike. There are no colors anymore. There are no walls. This is true. I changed the order of my books on the shelves. 2 days later, the war broke out. Beware of changing the order of your books. What are you thinking? What thinking? What you? You? Is there still you? You there? I keep asking myself this question. Because even the State Department, when they are asked by journalists, can you tell us about a safe zone where people can go and they will not get bombed? Can you tell us? I mean, because this is a humanitarian, where is one place that everyone in Gaza can go without being bombed? Because Israel has been bombing every place, including the humanitarian, the so-called humanitarian area. Where should people go? Should they build a big ladder and go up? But heaven has been blocked by the drones and F-16s and the smoke of death. My son, not Mustafa, the older one, my son asks me whether when we return to Gaza, I could get him a puppy. I say, I promise, if we can find any. I ask my son if he wishes to become a pilot when he grows up. He says he won't wish to drop bombs on people and houses. When we die, our souls leave our bodies, take with them everything they loved in our bedrooms, the perfume bottles, the makeup, the necklaces, the pens. In Gaza, our bodies and rooms get crushed. Nothing remains for the soul. Even our souls, they get stuck under the rubble for weeks. Thank you. Can I just 1 minute? I mean, there is one poem that I published after the book was published. I just want to read, because I've never read it before in any readings. So this is a gift to Syracuse. It's a long poem, but I will just read one part. It was published by Zitio. If we stay in our houses, they bomb us. If we shelter in a school, they bomb us. If we run to a hospital, they bomb us. If we move into a tent, they bomb us. If we go to a toilet, they bomb us. If we run from an airstrike, they bomb us. If we do not do any of this, they still bomb us. If we stay like a tree or temporarily leave like a leaf in the fall, they bomb us. But spring will come. And they, those who bomb us, will find no bombs among the flowers. We will be on the trees, bathing in the sun. And they, those who bomb us, will have no sun, no place to rest, no legs to run. Thank you. Shukran.
Mosab, as a Gazan, what would you like the people in this room to do to get the word out so that our government will stop participating in this genocide.
Mm-hmm. I think that most people here have been doing the right thing, which is to amplify the voices of the people and tell the personal stories of the people who have been killed on a daily basis, marching, protesting, calling their representatives and their senators, calling out the criminals. But I think that emphasizing that what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Palestine, did not start on October 7. And the fact that I had some poems in my first poetry collection, some of them were written in 2017 and 19, etc., I mean, is a testimony that we have been killed on a daily basis. What's different about this genocide is that it's happening very intensely. That not only are people killed, but also the houses where they have been living. I mean, I would like here to talk about the refugee camp. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker about the decimation of the refugee camp. I mean, these people in the refugee camp were living in the refugee camp because they were waiting for a return. I mean, why do we call it a refugee camp? It is a camp. It is a temporary place. But now what Israel is doing is killing the refugees and also killing the camp. So, I mean, this in itself, for me, this is the biggest crime. And for the world, the whole world, not to step in and ask the right questions. Why are we here now? How did we come so far until, why are we here? You know? Who are these people in Gaza? 70% of these people are refugees, including me. And my children, the great-grandchildren of the people who were expelled from Jaffa in 1948. So the real question that should be asked, not only about the current genocide, but also the genocide that started even before 1948. If you go back to history, it's very important to know how Zionism was able to create this state. Not only did Britain promise that land to the Jewish people or to the Zionist people, but also America. I was very naive. I thought America took part in the Israel-Palestine issue in maybe in 1960s or 50s. No. They were there even before 1948. Because when Britain withdrew from Palestine, I mean, it's very shameful that Britain withdrew from Palestine and left the Zionists to do the job of creating this state. Because when they couldn't deal with the Palestine problem, they said, okay, now we'll move it to the United Nations. And they said, okay, we will leave Palestine, end the mandate in 6 months. And that's when Israel, I mean, the month that the British left Palestine, Israel said, okay, we start from now. So, I mean, I think talking about history, that this administration not only involved in the genocide, but also in the creation of Israel, which means the devastation of the Palestinian people, which continues until now. So America is not only guilty of being involved in the genocide, but also in, I will not say the creation of Israel, but in the devastation and the destruction of Palestine. So I think talking about these issues, these points, is as important as talking about the current situation. So your politicians, I think many of them don't know anything about this. Your politicians, and I think many senators and many representatives, are just ignorant about the real issue, the problem of Palestine. The problem of Palestine is not about Hamas, not about the PLO. It's way, way more before than this. So I think educating not only people, but also your politicians, you know? I think these politicians who step in to represent you, I mean, you are more educated than them. So why should they represent you? So it's either you educate them or they just leave. And you should lead. I mean, this country should lead the world to a better place. They have everything. This country has everything, unless some of you disagree. You have 10 million square kilometers. You have a lot of resources in this country. You should help people stand on their feet, not do what you did 500 years ago to the native population. And I think we know why America doesn't call it a genocide, right? Why they don't, everyone is saying it's a genocide, Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch. They say genocide, but America say, well, we disagree. I mean, you disagree about what? What is one thing that you disagree with these people? I mean, these people are the human rights organization. They know what genocide is. You don't know.
We're supplying the bombs.
Yes, excellent. I mean, if they call it a genocide, it means that they are incriminating themselves. Yeah. So we know why they don't want to say it, because they are doing what they did is even. I think I don't want to compare, you know, genocides. It's unfair to compare the Holocaust with the Palestinian genocide or with the Native American genocide. It's unfair. But we call the similarities between these things. But for me as a Palestinian, this genocide is not less awful than what happened throughout history to other nations. At least for one reason, that we are watching it. It's not something that we are told about. People are not telling us, oh, you know, our grandparents were expelled 300 years ago, or 400, or 100 years ago. No, no. Come look. They are expelling people from North Gaza. They are blowing up the houses. They are targeting hospitals. They are blocking the humanitarian aid. I mean, it's not something that I'm telling you about. No, no, you are watching it with me. There is no reason why you should not, as an American, be involved in the advocacy for the Palestinian people. I mean, you see it. It's not that someone tells you about it. No, you see it. And you feel, and this is true, you feel that you are contributing. If you keep silent, you are contributing to the genocide because it is your money that is going. And I feel very sad because I get paid in this country and my money is taxed and some of it is going to kill maybe my nephew or my niece. So it's very hard for me to be here because I pay taxes. Against my will, of course. At least what we should do as people who live in this country is to pay something to the Palestinian people. Because this government is taking your tax money and sending it to Israel, and it's not a secret. What you can do is paying the Palestinian people by stopping this. I know we can't say, okay, stop. Of course, they will not stop the way we want them to stop. It's not like when America says, okay, send them weapons, send them 2,000 pounds bombs. We can't do the same thing. And I'm not asking anyone to send bombs to Palestinians, of course. But I mean, at least we should protect the Palestinian people by halting the weapon shipment from this country. Yeah. Blocking these people from sending bombs that we pay for to kill other people. And I have one question. What does this country have to do with people who live 5,000 miles away? I mean, you live here in this country. I mean, what is your business? Really? Why do you have even to say anything about us? Not you, of course. But I mean, people in general. Who are you, Aslan? Anjad, really? Who are you? It's not about America, but it's also about European colonization. I mean, people who are living in some continent go to other countries and they destroy them and... For me, it's more than this. Israel is not only killing people, but they are occupying the land itself. So it's a double crime. It was not enough what they did in 1948 and what they continue to do in the West Bank and also in Gaza. But also now they are continuing. I mean, I was wondering in the past, how did the Palestinian refugees reach that point? My grandparents and my parents. How did we arrive at that point? How did we live in refugee camps for 70 years? What kind of journey our grandparents took when they were expelled from Jaffa to Gaza? And now I see what's happening. It's happening now again. We see, and I was one of them, we see how we were expelled from our houses in Beit Lahia after our house was bombed even. And then we lived in refugee camps. And we are not allowed to return even to the destroyed houses. People who are now in the northern part of Gaza are not allowed to return to the northern part of Gaza, even to the destruction. No one is allowed. It's the same what happened in 1948. But the difference in 1948 is that Israel, after they expelled 60% of the population, Israel in 1948 expelled 60% of the Palestinians. And they announced the establishment of Israel. And 1 year after that, they were admitted to the United Nations. See, it's difficult, right? So it took Israel 1 year to be a member of the United Nations. You see, you create a state. You expel 60% of the local population, and 1 year later, you are granted a membership. Let's do this, everyone. But now it's taking the world 16 months until now to impose a ceasefire, to stop the killing of families. This is not a genocide against people, not against Palestinians. It's a genocide against refugees. I said that 70% of the population in Gaza are refugees. So these people, refugees who were supposed to be helped out by the world community to achieve their freedom, achieve their return. That is guaranteed by international law. Instead of them being helped out, even before October 7th, to arrive at a settlement for their problem, the refugee problem. No, these people are killed now. And now they are made refugees again. And we are watching this. So, I mean, it's devastating even to talk about these things as they are happening. I mean, if the United States, the country that is practicing its control on Middle Eastern countries, can't stop Israel, how do we even imagine that Middle Eastern countries putting some pressure on the United States itself? I mean, this is the problem. The problem is with America itself. I mean, some people say, oh, why doesn't Egypt help you? Why? Where are the Arab people? Where are the Arab people? I mean, who is practicing its control on the Arab world? It's America. So, I mean, I don't imagine that the Arab world or the Middle Eastern countries will tell U.S., please, can you tell your friend to shut up, to stop the killing? I mean, it is the responsibility of the people who supply weapons to tell people, stop it. Okay, we gave you weapons. It was, you know, self-defense. But no, it's not the self-defense. I mean, destroying a refugee camp or destroying 70% of Gaza is not self-defense. And killing your own hostages is not self-defense. And stealing more and more lands from Palestine in the West Bank, it's not self-defense. What's happening is that people, you know, so let's say this is my land, and now I think that Julia could be an enemy of mine, so I'm going to occupy her land. And then I will find John, and he may pose a threat. I will expel him. So this is how Israel is working. See, okay, we are here because in 1947, Israel was given, as part of the partition plan, about 50% of the land. Although the Jews or the Zionists in 1948, do you know how much they owned in Palestine? Less than 7%. The Zionists in Palestine owned only 7% of the land. I mean, okay, so there were Jews in Palestine.
Yes.
These were citizens of Palestine.
Yes.
But I mean, they did not own 7% of the land. Themselves, they did not own 7%, because the people who started coming after, I think they were 1% of the Palestinians before the Balfour Declaration. But then I count everyone who came to Palestine after the Balfour as Zionist. Because they immigrated to Palestine in the hope of building a state. Yeah. So this is the difference. Of course, they were Jewish people, and of course, that's a Musallam. Yani. There is no argument about that. But I mean that they were given more than they deserved and more than they owned, and they continued to expand. And now it was not enough for them, you know, to occupy about 50 or 70% of Palestine. Now you see, and this is not a secret, you see some Zionists from Israel saying, we want to build settlements in Gaza. And you see the patch on the Israeli army's uniform, and there is the map of Greater Israel, which constitutes of Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, but not the United States, it's far away. So it's very clear. I mean, you don't have to tell anyone what to do when it comes to humanity. We are watching humanity genocided, not Palestinian people. Humanity is genocided because it's not that people are being killed, but we as human beings, we are watching them killed. And we are watching them trying to survive and killed. We saw Sha'ban al-Dalo, who was, you know, Sha'ban al-Dalo, the young man who moved to a tent after his house was destroyed. He moved to a tent on the area of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, and the tent area was targeted. And he died in the fire of the airstrike. And if you ask anyone in the administration, you say, well, we are waiting for our Israeli friends, to tell us what happened. And when you ask about the Hind Rajab, who was killed with her family, until today, the State Department didn't say anything why it happened and why they continued to send Israel the same weapons that killed that girl. But when October 7th happened, no one said, okay, let's wait and see what happened exactly. This admin did not say, okay, on October 7th, there were some atrocities. We will wait for some reports, see what happened exactly. But no, they went out, terrorists, savages, human animals. And nowadays, we are reading some reports that many Israelis who were killed on October 7th were killed by Israel itself. But, I mean, it's easy to send weapons, but it's very hard. I'm talking about the U.S. It's very hard for them to convince whoever has the weapons how to use it. And I see this word all the time. The U.S. State Department said, we encourage our friends in Israel. We encourage them to be more careful. What? Encourage? You encourage your student to write a poem. You encourage your child to eat cereal, to drink zero sugar tea. But you encourage Israel, you know, to be careful when you kill people. What is this word, encourage? So we talk about democracy. And it is a shameful thing that 70% at least of the population in the States want to impose an embargo, right? So 70% of the people want a ceasefire. Why is it not happening? Isn't this democracy? So 70% of the people of this country who is supplying the weapons want a ceasefire. But it's not happening because America is encouraging. It's encouraging, you see? So what gives me hope is the more and more people I see who become involved in the advocacy on behalf of the Palestinian people, especially among the young people, student encampments, because I think these people, the young generation, will be the leader of the future. It will be a catastrophe that we will have the same leaders in about 20 or 30 years. So this is what I am hoping for, that this young generation who is enlightened and who knows the history of Palestine is going to lead to a change for the better for everyone in the world, not only for Palestine. Everywhere in the world. So this is why where my hope lies. It's in the advocacy that we are watching, the solidarity movement in the United States and in Europe and everywhere. I hope that this will lead for a positive change for everyone. One last comment. You saw when Hillary Clinton was awarded the Freedom Medal or Medal of Freedom, whatever it is, this same woman, when the students were organizing, she said, these students, they don't know anything about Israel-Palestine. I mean, these are Columbia students and Harvard students. You say they don't understand. But I mean, these are smart people. These are the smartest people in the country. And you, when they organize and oppose the genocide, you say, you know, they don't know about the history. Well, you know what? I don't want to know about the history. I see people dying and burning in tents. So I don't want to know about Zionism or Hamas or PLO. I don't want to know about the word Palestine and Israel. It's enough for me to see people dying. And that was enough for me to ask for a ceasefire. What I'm asking people is, if they do not understand what's happening, because people sometimes say, oh, it's complicated when you start to talk about Palestine and Israel. Oh, it's complicated, you know, both sides. But okay, let's say you don't understand. You don't want to use your mind to figure out what's happening. At least let your heart work. You are watching people in Gaza buried under the rubble for months. People burning in tents. Children dying because there is not enough food. The husband of a neighbor of ours a few days ago passed away because he was on medication and he ran out of the medicine. He died. So doesn't this move you? Doesn't the Lancet medical journal report that in last July, this is a medical journal, it's not Hamas, it's not me, it's not Iran, it is Lancet medical journal in the UK. They said in last July that it is not implausible to think that about 170,000 people died, killed or died because of Israel's campaign. So the husband of our neighbor died because there is no medication. Why is there no medication? Because Israel is imposing a siege on Gaza. So Israel killed him. My grandfather, the last grandfather I had, passed away last April. Why? Because there are no ambulances, no hospitals, no medications. And there was no phone signal, by the way. So even if there is an ambulance or a hospital, he died in the refugee camp, the Jebel refugee camp. So there is no phone signal even, hello, hospital, hello, ambulance, please come take me, I'm sick. There's no phone signal. So who killed my grandfather? Israel. So that was last July, they said 170. You know 170,000? It's about 10% of Gaza's population. Now it's more. And if we are going to wait for more, how many will die in the coming few months? And this is the question for me about genocide. Genocide is not about how many people died or the percentage of people who died. No. It's about what happens if this does not stop. Because in Israel's intent is very obvious, and what they are doing is obvious. And I liken it to a fire in the house. So you are cooking and there is your child lights some fire, you know, in the corner of the kitchen, and it's a small fire. And you look and say, oh, it's a small fire. There is no need to call the firefighters. You know, it's small. And then it becomes bigger. And then, no, still, it's not a fire that necessitates, you know, firefighters or fire trucks. And the question is, do we have to wait until there is a big fire to call the firefighters? And the question, the same question about people who disagree about calling this a genocide. Do we have to wait until it's 15% to 20% of people in Gaza? Oh, it's a genocide. Okay, and then what? What do? You call it a genocide? No, we call something, we name something because we want to change something. We don't wait until we have the complete definition. Although what's happening in Gaza meets the definition of genocide. Even let's say doesn't meet the whole criteria of the genocide. Let's say it meets one. Oh, do we have to wait until it meets two and three other points of the genocide? And then it's a genocide? And then what, Mr. Genocide Denier? So what do? I said I don't like to compare. But let's say in the late 1930s, early 1940s, the Nazis were killing the Jewish people and putting them in concentration camps. Now, let's say we are living during those days and we saw a Nazi. Hi, Nazi. Are you committing a Holocaust against the Jewish people? What would he say?
No.
He would say no. Do you put Jews in the concentration camp? No, these are lies, you know. Of course, every genocider or a Holocaust perpetrator will deny what they are doing. But in this case, we are watching it. We don't need anyone even to say this is it. We don't need your opinion, Aslan. We don't need to hear what you think. Because we see, we don't want anyone to help us see what we see, because we see it. We have two eyes, not one. So I have hope again in the young generation, the students, and I hope they will be the leaders of change for the best in the world. Khalas, thank you. Thank you.